so we don't have anything else on the agenda. Senator Stumpf is not here. Senator Metzen moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Saltzman.
And on this bill, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for having this meeting today to hear this bill. This is a bill that addresses some of the concerns that have come forward over the past year regarding charter school and their lease aid. And last year we did a major reform bill for charter schools. It was an award-winning bill in that we now have the strongest charter school law here in Minnesota. And one of the issues that came up as we had that discussion related to, you know, facilities. And so Senator Stumpf asked that we reconvene a charter school working group to be able to work on charter school lease aid facilities and look at policies that were created over a decade ago. This past November, there was an article in the Star Tribune about lease aid, and it was very concerning to the public. It had to do with how charter schools are using higher interest loans to, you know, secure buildings. A 2003 legislative auditor's report addressed the fact that there's a loophole in that state law right now says that you may not use lease aid to purchase a building. But what's happened over the past decade is that affiliated building corporations have been instituted as a way around the law, as sort of a conduit so that a charter school can use their lease aid to rent from their affiliated building company and then purchase a building. So all of this is it's troubling to the public, and it seems that we should be able to find another way to do this. And so our charter school working group had four meetings over December and January looking at how we purchase buildings for our public schools, how we bond for other public buildings, and then how we're using a process now that seems to go around the policies that have been set here in our state. And as a result of that, we saw some models in other states and also work with our investment community. We work with the charter school community. We worked with our administration to come up with a process whereby charter schools that are ready to purchase buildings, that are successful both academically and also fiscally, could start to move forward, but to have a process that is overseen by the public and also by the state. And so this bill creates a charter school facilities authority as a way for charter schools to become endorsed, to then move forward and then to, you know, secure financing for their buildings that would be at a lower interest rate, and also just to have the oversight that we think is very, very important. It has been worked on extensively since it was introduced. We knew when it was first introduced we had some holes in it, but it was a good place to start the discussion. I want to commend the Department of MMB and also of our Education Department for working with us. Since the bill was heard in Education and passed out last Thursday, we've worked on two other sections, and those are reflected in the A27 amendment, Mr. Chair. So with that, Mr. Nauman is here to be able to just go through the bill. It's very technical, but just to give you an overview of what is in it.
Mr. Chairman, has the division report been moved?
Yes. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, are we going straight into the overall bill, or did you want to address the amendment first?
Well, let's have a description of the bill and what's going on, and then we'll go to the amendments.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I think the easiest way to talk about this is that there are, from a finance perspective, under current law, charter schools receive revenue for their facilities from one source, and that is the charter school building lease aid program. It's based on a formula that generates revenue for charter schools, essentially 90% of their lease, or $1,200, with the exception of some charter schools based on a budget deal, a compromise back in 2003 that allowed some charter schools to have a higher cap amount. But it's financing for leases. As Senator Salzman articulated just a few moments ago, there have been some charter schools that have created affiliated building corporations, friend groups that have taken out bonds on behalf of the charter school, purchased or constructed a new building, and used the lease aid as payment to support the ongoing debt service for those facilities. And that is essentially the mechanism that that the bill attempts to end. And however, because those charter schools have gone through that existing process, you can't put the toothpaste back into the tube, essentially. And what is done is those charter schools are moved into a new finance mechanism called Building Lease Transition Aid. And essentially, if you are a named charter school in the bill under Building Lease Transition Aid, the finance mechanism for those charter schools remains relatively the same with very few changes. and that's how you deal with those charter schools that are leasing. They will end up in one of those two pots. But the primary changes to the bill is that charter schools will now be able to, through an application to the new authority which is created in the bill, the Charter School Facilities Authority, to apply and be approved and then use the ongoing state aid payments to support the purchase of a building through the letting of bonds that the Charter School Facilities Authority will make. So if a charter school is approved through the authority, and we can talk about that through the language of the bill at your pleasure, then a charter school would use the aid payments that accrue to them, and in this case, the charter school lands in a pot called facilities aid, that those charter schools would then use their state aid payments to pay off the bonds.
They have this, and I think they have this.
And Mr. Chair, do members have this document?
Yes.
This might be an easy way to think through this. I didn't realize that had been handed out. So the box on the left, the building lease aid, represents the essentially the existing system with some changes to the grandfather clause. Those with ABCs, affiliated building corporations, will end up in the building lease transition, and then all of the charters, any of the charter schools that meet the eligibility criteria can apply to the authority and then would, and if approved, to take out bonds through the authority, would receive facilities aid. And one of the permutations of this that is an improvement over the current situation is that part of the aid that an approved or an endorsed charter school receives, 6% of equal to 6% of the principal and interest, is deposited in a new account in the special revenue fund called the Charter School Facilities Credit Enhancement Account, and that's what that circle represents. So annually, 6% of a charter school's P&I is deposited in that account, and that account is there for the purposes of in the occasion, the unfortunate occasion, if a charter school were to default on the bonds. That account would then be used to make the payments on behalf of that charter school. I think it's anticipated by most individuals associated with this bill that there would, hopefully that would never occur, but the primary benefit of it is it would provide an additional risk reduction in the marketplace. If bond investors can see that there is a special account that underwrites the bonds, then lower interest rates theoretically result. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll pause there and see if there's a desire to go through the language or answer questions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you could, I know I've had a chance to talk to you and Senator Saltzman about the bill, but if you could maybe just offer a couple of minutes about how the language in the bill, you know, dovetails with what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure.
And then explain how the financing mechanisms that you have in the bill.
Maybe what I'll do is just go quickly through the division report, skipping over some of the more simple but the less relevant language. I think, Mr. Chairman and members, if we begin by working through first, I think what's, Mr. Chairman. Okay, page 12. One of the key components of the bill is to set forth under the leased space language under what conditions a charter school may lease and from whom. And that's done in paragraph A. Previously, it was pretty much an open process that the charter schools, if they could find a building, were able to lease from them. But what happened was that many charter schools elected to create these affiliated building corporations, and that's essentially what Senator Salzman's bill is designed to end. And paragraph A addresses that point. There's an amendment that's going to change paragraph B that creates an exception for certain liability issues. Paragraph C is the operative language for leasing that allows a charter school that's in the building lease transition pot, if you will, lease under the old arrangement. So they can continue to lease from their affiliated nonprofit building corporation. This is important language that we've spent a fair amount of discussion on. Section 9 of the bill, beginning on the bottom of page 14, is some language that requires the Department of Administration and MDE to publish a list of vacant and unused buildings. There's an implicit or maybe even more of an explicit desire on the part of the author to have an incentive for charter schools to be looking for existing buildings rather than buying new buildings. And this was seen as a way to make information available. Many school districts are having to contract their buildings, Minneapolis, St. Paul, most notably, and having that information available to charter schools is an important step. Section 10 of the bill works in conjunction with the facilities aid. A charter school that has bonds, takes out bonds and is paying them off, will receive 100% of their principal and interest paid to that charter school in a single payment or in a metered payment, but it'll come in the form of lease aid in the form of a facilities aid payment. In order to have the formulas work together, it was relevant to have under Section 10 a deduction off of general education revenue. And I can go into detail about that, but for the moment, we'll just leave it there. The notion is that the bonding community wanted to see that now that we're talking about bonds, they wanted to see that 100% of the dollars that are necessary to make the debt service payments on part of these bonds is in fact coming directly to districts. So instead of doing a formula that was 90% or a cap, the way we would do with a lease arrangement, we gave the charters 100% of their facilities aid and then made the adjustment for the cross subsidy, if you will, on the general education calculation. Under Section 11 of the bill, charter schools must reserve that are endorsed and receiving taking out bonds must reserve $100 per pupil unit of their operating capital revenue for maintenance costs. That's a good prevention measure to ensure that there's revenue to upkeep of the building. The building lease aid formula is Section 12. That's the old formula, but we've added new reporting requirements, information that a charter school must present to the Department of Education, things like the owner of the building, the list of the current board members, a copy of the lease, enrollment projections, and it's all it's set forth in the bill. The notion here is to provide, even for those that are leasing, a better sense of really what information that supports the overall lease. So that's the building lease aid formula. I don't want to glance over this. This is important. On page 17, the stricken language on 17.23 and 24 is eliminates the 2003 grandfather provision that a collection of charter schools benefited from as a result of the the budget compromise in that year. However, it's extended for one additional year, and that's language on 17.26 through 2.8. So they can receive it for one additional year. There's language in the later in the bill that permits the Department of Education to extend that for even one more year after that, if a charter school has been unable to renegotiate its lease. Did you want to speak to the renegotiation?
Yes. On that point, Mr. Chair, you know, one of the things that we have heard from the charter school community is that when a landlord knows exactly how much lease aid a school can, you know, spend on their lease because it's set in statute, it's really hard to really negotiate a better lease. And so one of the things that in this economy right now that we're hearing is that a lot of businesses are going out and renegotiating their leases because of the economics, because of, you know, the business climate. And so this is an attempt that, you know, about 140 charter schools are getting, you know, the $1,200 that is allowed. And these schools that, you know, are grandfathered in, we believe that over time they should be able to also renegotiate their leases, at least to give them a nudge to do that seems very, very important. So that is why we are phasing this in and have allowed language so that, you know, the commissioner can work with them if they're unable to renegotiate a lease. Those schools that are getting the grandfathered amount because they have loans out can continue to receive, you know, the higher amount. But particularly for leases, this is an attempt to help, you know, negotiate that.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, continuing on with the bulk of the bill, at the bottom of page 17 is section 13. This is the facilities aid portion of the bill. And as I talked about earlier, this works in conjunction with that general education deduction. This section provides an endorsed charter school with aid equal to 100% of its principal and interest. And it aligns with that earlier section, and it creates an implicit cap of 1120, which is 6% lower than the 1200 cap that we talked about on the facility, or correction, on the lease aid. Beginning on page 18, the aid is required to be used on the loan payments, and on page 8, page 18.8, once the bonds are paid off, a charter school will be eligible to receive $400 per pupil unit for maintenance costs, and the aid must, in fact, be used for that purpose. Section 14 of the bill creates that credit enhancement account. This is that 6% that I mentioned before. Paragraph B deposits 6% of the principal and interest for any endorsed charter school into that credit enhancement account. The funds benefit all endorsed charter schools. And I think that's an important notion. The account also may receive grants and gifts. So I know there have been some individuals that have talked about perhaps helping to capitalize that account. So it was important to allow grants and gifts be made eligible. Section 15 of the bill requires charter schools to notify the commissioner if a charter school intends to sell or transfer property. And if it does so, those sales must be at appraised market value. Section 16 of the bill allows eligible charters to apply for building lease transition aid. This is that pot in the upper right-hand corner of the chart that we referred to earlier, and you're eligible based on a later section in the bill. There are requirements beginning on line 17 that sets the information that needs to be provided in the BLT aid, and there's going to be some adjustments of some of these sections as a result of an amendment, but line 32 requires an agreement. One of the key requirements to being eligible here is that there needs to be an agreement between a charter school and its lease that once let me back up. The charter schools that are receiving the BLT aid are those that have the nonprofit building corporation. So they have an organization that they're working through to, in a sense, buy a building on their behalf. And Senator Salzman's bill creates an eligibility requirement on the aid that would support those ongoing debt payments, debt service payments, to be that once those bonds are paid off, that the building would transfer in ownership to the charter school. So in the end, the charter school would own the building, not the nonprofit affiliated building corporation. Does that make sense? On page 20, we set forth information. There's information required annually, and some of it required only when there's changes. That's what paragraph C does. Paragraph D gives the commissioner the authority to deny aid if information is not provided. And if you take a look at paragraph E, it will look remarkably similar to the formula that we have in the lease aid formula. The difference being that the grandfathers under the transition building lease program are continued until the bonds are paid off. So there is no turning off of the grandfather for those charter schools, unless the charter school decides to convert from transition into actually purchasing the building through the authority. Section 17 is a mechanical administrative section that pulls the three facilities, building lease aid, facilities aid, and building lease transition aid together to create a single appropriation. Section 18 is the operative section that prevented charter schools from actually using state aid to buy buildings or land. You'll note that the section now permits that if the charter school is endorsed. Section 19 is on page 21 is a pretty technical change. On page 22 at the bottom, we return, this is language that returns any remaining facilities to the state in the event of a closure. So one of the implicit changes in the bill is that if a charter school fails, that now that is considered a state asset, and it would credit back to the state at the same, in the same way that other assets of a charter school would credit to the state. And if that charter school is sold, it must be made, the sale must be at market value, or a charter school could transfer that ownership of that facility directly to a school district or a different charter school. Section 20, beginning on the bottom of page 22, creates the Charter School Facilities Authority. There are 8 members of this authority. 5 are appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation. All must be Minnesota residents, and 2 must reside outside the metro area. Paragraph B sets forth, based on a collection of expertise, the 5 appointees made by the governor, and paragraph C requires that this authority be administered by the Department of Management and Budget. There is one non-voting member of the Minnesota, and that member is the president of the, or his or her designee of the Minnesota School Boards Association.
So, Mr. Nauman, is that the 8th member?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Subdivision 3 sets the terms, compensation, removal conditions. Subdivision 4 establishes duties, allows fees to be collected. There's at the bottom of that section on line 24.4 allows the authority to hire or contract for services. Subdivision 5.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
What is the duration of the those jobs that you cited? How long are they going to be running the organization, I guess?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Foley, the authority has the flexibility to decide how long a member of the authority will serve. But in a couple of occasions, we know that they're named individuals, that the commissioner of management and budget, the commissioner of education, or their designees serve, but then there are gubernatorial appointees. So presumably they would, perhaps Mr. Watson can speak more directly to that, but that would coincide with a gubernatorial term.
Mr. Chairman, when you look at that, you've got a lot of language in there, but I don't see anything that deals with the duration of their appointments.
On that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, if you look in subdivision 3, 23.23 and down, it it addresses that with the membership terms, compensation, removal of members, fillings of vacancies shall be provided in section 15.0575. Maybe Mr. Watson could provide some background on that particular provision.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, that's the standard language for administrative boards that provides for 4-year staggered terms for the members.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm on page 24. Charter schools must, under subdivision 5, and this will be addressed in a subsequent amendment to kind of reorder how some of this appears to make it a little bit clearer. But a charter school must exist for 5 years or greater to seek endorsement. And if you meet the 5-year threshold, you're eligible to purchase a new building if you meet the conditions that are set forth in points 1 through 9. Beginning on line 24.32, we set basically very similar criteria, but in that occasion, a charter school that exists for 8 years or longer is eligible to either purchase a building or construct a new building. And I should add that I think I glanced over this earlier. When a school district contemplates the creation of a new school, and the value of the project is excess of $1.4 million, they must go through a review and comment process through the Department of Education. It's a way of saying, does this building meet all the relevant codes? Is it fire safe? And now a charter school that will be going through the authority process will also have to meet those same guidelines, and the threshold for that is also $1.4 million. And that occurs whether you're buying or whether you're creating a new building. Subdivision 6 on page 25 requires the authority to make the determination of what's called the endorsement. We needed a term to define what charter schools were, in a sense, given the authorization to go through the bonding process, and that term is endorsement. And we'll see that used on a couple of occasions. Later on in that subdivision, we established the different criteria, a different set of criteria for charter schools that are in the transition aid program. And primarily there, what we're talking about is, as part of the authority's determination to provide a charter school that's in the transition pot the ability to take out bonds, we want to ensure that that the authority is taking into account the amount of outstanding debt that the charter school has, and the financing costs and the debt that are being paid. Essentially, is it good financial time for that charter school to make the transition from working through its affiliated nonprofit building corporation and going through the authority? For example, perhaps there's 6% rates that are undergirding the bonds at this point, and at some point in the future, maybe there's only 7% bonds available, so maybe that would not be a good time. So we'd want the authority to be contemplating the existing debt that's essentially been taken out by the affiliated nonprofit building corporation to ensure that there's a good timing here. So that's an additional criteria that's happening in that subdivision. Mr. Chairman and member, Mr. Chairman and members, moving on to section 21 of the bill. I mentioned that the notion of an endorsed charter school, that's subdivision 1 of that section requires the authorities to approve charters for borrowing. It sets a limit on the amount of borrowing based on the general 16% of the general ed reduction that we talked about earlier. Subdivision 2 defines the endorsement. Subdivision 3 requires the charter school to provide a mortgage to the authority and allows that mortgage to be assigned to a trustee. Subdivision 4 prohibits the use of the term endorsement on promotional materials. So the endorsement notion, so you receive an endorsement, it's for a project, and it can only be used for the purposes here, not for using on educational promotional materials. Section 22 allows the board of a charter school with a 2/3 vote to acquire facilities with bonds in anticipation of aid. So the Board of a Charter School, to go through that endorsement process, is going to have to pass by a two-thirds vote that they want to actually proceed with that. Section 23 permits the authority to issue revenue bonds. Line 5 permits the authority to enter in a loan agreement with an endorsed charter school. Paragraph B permits the authority to exercise power of the municipality for financing buildings and requires either a competitive or negotiated sale for those bonds. Paragraph C is an important paragraph. It establishes an overall cap not to exceed $150 million. That was an administrative recommendation. Lines subdivision 2 says that the full faith and credit of the state is not pledged behind these bonds, and there is no taxing power pledged, that the revenue stream that supports these bonds is based on an appropriation which may be reduced, repealed at any time, and the bond documents must contain a conspicuous notice statement to that effect. Subdivision 3 establishes that regardless of whether the federal government changes the taxability of the any bonds, that these bonds will remain in effect. Section 24 on page 28 first begins with a definition of bonds issued by the authority and establishes the conditions and processes if a charter school is unable to make payments. We talked about earlier that the charter school credit enhancement account. This is where the credit enhancement account comes into play. If a charter school can't make its payments, subdivision 2 sets forth a process that charter school and the two departments working together will go through to begin making the payments out of the credit enhancement account. Paragraph B, in fact, requires the payment from the charter school credit enhancement account. Paragraph C requires the two departments to develop a procedure for notification and how that process would work administratively. Subdivision 3 requires charters to pay principal and interest if a charter school has to begin, is unable to make the payments and they have to begin effectuating the system. Charter will have to pay interest to the state. Also, if a charter has to use this section, there is a reduction to general education aid or aid paid to the charter school, and that's subdivision 4, and those reductions would then be credited back to the credit enhancement account. Paragraph B allows the Department of Education to recommend extending that repayment to ensure that a charter school is not thrown out of business just because they happen to have had a momentary difficulty. So if the process would normally say that there's a certain time period, the Department of Education can extend it to ensure the health of the charter school. Subdivision 5 requires the development of a plan. In subdivision 6, says that the Department of Management and Budget is not required to issue warrants to make the payments if it's believed that making the payments on behalf of a charter school would negatively affect the state bond rating. I don't think anyone anticipates that this section would ever become operative, but I think that there's some comfort that's applied as a result of having it. Subdivision 7 allows the Department of Management and Budget Commissioner to enter disclosure agreements on the bonds associated with the charter schools. Section 25 redefines the definition of a public building to include a charter school. Section 26, and we're going to see some amendment to this section, is last year's K-12 appropriation for the charter school building lease aid program that will be adjusted to, it's being adjusted downward here to reflect the fact that we're creating a single appropriation for the three new accounts. Section 27 is the Department of Education appropriation, and adding an appropriation for the Minnesota Management and Budget on lines 32.3 through 32.6. That's primarily administrative dollars for getting the authority up and running. The base is continued in the future at $147,000. I mentioned earlier in the discussion that those charter schools with affiliated nonprofit building corporations were listed in the bill. That's subdivision one. That's how a charter school becomes eligible for the transition building lease aid program. Subdivision two allows the MDE some program management flexibility to move charter schools from one to the other. Subdivision three offers some generalized requirements on affiliated nonprofit building corporations. Section 29 begins a discussion that I've neglected to mention earlier. You'll notice on the tracking sheet that in fiscal 12 and 13 that charter school startup aid, which is an account in the K-12 division's jurisdiction, is reduced in fiscal 12 and 13. Those dollars are reallocated and put into the, and you'll see that in section 30, moving from the dollars from charter school startup aid into the credit enhancement account as a way of capitalizing that account to ensure lower interest rates for charter schools. Section 31 is also a section I mentioned earlier. If a charter school is unable to renegotiate its lease and it's a grandfather charter school, it is allowed to petition to the agency to get an extension for 1 year at 50% of the difference between its grandfather and the cap. Then the appropriation in Section 32 is the new charter school building aid, which is the sum of lease aid, facilities aid, and transition aid. And Section 33 is a repealer that repeals the startup aid in fiscal 13 and the affiliated nonprofit building corporation definition, which is no longer necessary under the language of the bill. Mr. Chairman, that was a little longer than I think you intended, but there's a lot going on.
And Mr. Nauman, on the appropriation for the Facilities Authority, we talked about this earlier today. The request is $392,000. I didn't realize the base appropriation is $147,000. So what's the difference?
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note does go into some discussion on that. I think what's happening here is that there's some startup costs associated with getting the authority up and running, and then the ongoing costs drop down to $147,000 a year.
So what would be the $150,000 needed to get the authority up and going?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that the MMB is here, and I think that they'd be in a better position to speak directly to that.
Ms. Cardell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The initial costs of the charters.
If you could just.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yourself. Kathy Cardell, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Management and Budget. Sorry about that. The initial cost, a charter school finance authority is not going to be useful to the charter school community unless a financing program is created and available for their use. So, in looking at what those initial costs would be, we will need to retain bond counsel and be able to pay for that. We will almost certainly want to go through an initial credit rating review process, which we will also have to pay for up front. We will have some other staff costs associated with this program that will be, you know, once you have an authority up and running with policies and procedures and so forth, it's a lesser amount, but without those dollars, we cannot retain bond counsel and pay them. And that's not going to be an inconsequential amount of money, because starting a new revenue bond program like this will be expensive.
But what's expensive?
Sarah Foley?
Tell us how much this is. I mean, if you got some figures.
Sure. We're estimating that the initial costs will be somewhere in the vicinity of $100,000 to $150,000. We're going to have to create a financing structure there will be a master bond or master trust indenture that then will be utilized by all the endorsed charter schools coming through once created. But we're going to have to go through a credit process with that initial structure as well.
Mr. Chairman, I have not served on this committee in the 14 years I've been here, but it seems to me that you need more information for us to really do much with anything. The one thing, I'm curious to know, when you're issuing bonds that organizations are able to piggyback on someone else, like the city here of St. Paul may do that and enhance their own rating through purchase. Is that correct, or am I lost there?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Foley, you know, I think perhaps the best example that I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but is kind of comparable is the Public Facilities Authority, which has its own bond council, its own financial advisor. It's created a financing program that political subdivisions utilize for purposes of financing water and wastewater facilities. Those participants, those borrowers, those political subdivisions may also bring their own counsel and advisors with them as they structure a loan agreement. They pay for that out of the cost of their loan, typically.
Mr. Chairman? Can one last shot here for now? On a recent day, we had people visiting the Capitol, and a number of those were from private institutions, some charter stuff. And I discussed that with them about how this worked, and they kept telling what wonderful education they were getting, and the fact was that the reason it was good was they were able to have a pupil-teacher ratio around 25 or less, and versus the public sector with 30 and 35 in some cases in the schools I've been in. And why would we harm, if you will, our competitors to create these public or private institutions?
Senator Saltzman.
There. On that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, I think I heard what you ask is, why are we doing this bill if it's competing with our district schools?
Yes.
Is that okay? Well, first of all, you know, our charter schools are public schools, and they receive the same per pupil dollars that our district schools do. A charter school, what makes them different is that we take away many of the mandates that our public schools, that our district schools need to follow. And that was intentional so that they could have greater flexibility, do some things, try some new things out. And over time, for about, you know, 15 years, we didn't touch that. We didn't really touch our charter school law. We did major reform last year because some of our charter schools are doing very well, but many of them are not addressing the achievement gap. So this particular bill, though, deals with the dollars that go to a charter school specifically for facilities. And when a school district goes out and needs facilities, and we heard from our district schools in our first meeting, they may need a new facility because it's aging, because it's old, because the roof is leaking, the windows are leaking, or they may need a new facility because they're growing. And charter schools may have the same needs. They want a better facility, or they're growing and need additional space. For a school district to get money to build a new building, we know what they have to do. They have to go to the voters. We heard from charter schools that sometimes have to go to voters 3, 4, 5 times before their levy is passed.
charter public district.
Right, the districts have to go. The districts have to go to their voters, you know, 3, 4, 5 times in order to get, you know, a levy passed. We heard from the U of M. They sometimes have to come to on the legislature before the bonding committee 1, 2, 3, or 4 times before they get a project passed. So it seems that charter schools have had a system where lease aid is there, and they've been able to, without any voter approval or any sort of endorsement or any kind of public process, they're able, through these affiliated building companies, to build or buy buildings that a district school would never be able to do. They're never going to be able to go to voters because they don't have a tax base. So this is a way that I would say, if you're concerned that we're giving a competitive edge to someone, all we're doing here is we're saying, if you want to own a building, there needs to be a process. It's a public process. And some would still argue that our district schools still have to jump over a lot more hurdles in order to, you know, access facilities. But there's going to be greater oversight before they can do that. And in addition, when those dollars are used to buy a building, the assets will stay in the public sector. That, as opposed now, these affiliated building companies are building buildings, and once they're paid off, they belong to a private nonprofit. We don't do that with other state funds. So this is just providing greater oversight. I think that, too, that while this seems really, really complex, we're trying to fix. I mean, if we had a clean slate, this bill would look very different. But the fact that we have all these affiliated building companies and we can't take them apart, they already have bonds out, we're trying to transition them. And that's what a lot is in this bill right here, is trying to fix a problem. Because we did not spend time in our committee digging up the dirt. I chose that we weren't going to spend a whole committee going over all the problems. We were going to tackle the problem and fix it. And that's what this bill really does. But there's been stories for the past year about charter school facilities. Right now they're going through other, a city or a housing authority. In one case, you know, a city was able to secure a fire truck in exchange for being the conduit. Those are education dollars. I think in this model, while it does have a startup cost, it's going to have greater efficiencies. We're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars right now on these deals. And this will make it more efficient. We'll have oversight. And I think for the charter school community, it gives them a sense of permanency and also stability. So it really addresses a lot of different issues. But I wouldn't say that we're helping our competitors, because these are kids. They're our kids. They're, you know, like the children of this state. And these are public schools. But we also need to hold them accountable.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, how does the cost in fiscal year 11 get paid for in this bill?
I think the answer, Senator Berglund, let me, if you don't mind my answering that.
I don't care who answers it. I'd just like to know.
It's because I was going to point that out to the committee. It's my understanding that Senator Stumpf has agreed to increase his target.
I see. So this will be paid for in the education bill that's yet to come?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Berglund.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, have we adopted the A27 amendment?
No, we haven't taken the amendments. I know there was some discussed testimony that, Senator Salzman, you wished
Mr.
to.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
I know that there's an A27 amendment, and has that been offered?
First, Senator Salzman, I think. No, not yet. Senator Salzman, first, I think you indicated you wanted a little bit of testimony. Is that correct?
So just a little bit, Mr. Chair,
yeah,
just
so
to hear from some of the departments. And I know that MMB has, you know, expressed support from this, and I wonder if you'd just like to hear from them again, because I think it's important to know that we have worked with the administration to, again, create something that we think is good policy.
Ms. Cardell, if you would talk.
Mr. Chairman, and is this, guess it's working. I'm going to just read for you the same statement that Commissioner Hansen gave in Senator Stumpf's committee last week. It seems like an eternity ago, because we have worked really closely with both MDE as well as Senator Saltzman and her staff, and I'll read the statement. The administration supports Senate File 2716 as currently drafted. We appreciate the willingness of the author and her staff to work with our agency to address concerns about mitigating the potential financial and credit risks to the state with the proposed creation of a charter school facilities authority. Specifically, we are pleased that Senator Saltzman incorporated our suggestion that the term of any revenue bonds issued be limited to 20 years. While we recognize that provision will reduce how much a charter school might be able to leverage their facilities aid to fund a project, we believe it will encourage schools to look at renovating existing space rather than building a new facility, another objective that I believe we share with Senator Saltzman. Finally, we believe that the current version of the bill will provide for greater transparency in the use of state resources that fund facilities for charter schools, as well as a lower cost of borrowing for those charter schools that are strong from both an educational achievement and financial perspective.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I think you ought to interject here the fact that Commissioner Hansen said that he started out as a total skeptic of this notion and did 180 degrees as he's worked through this that is and is very comfortable and very supportive of it. So this has been an interesting process, and I think you're looking at a proposal and a bill that has been pretty thoroughly vetted and responsive to a lot of the concerns and attempting to address it. There's a few that you're going to address with the amendment that were raised in the division that needed a little bit more work than we would hash out on committee time. So it's complicated, but it's very thorough, and I really have great respect for the investment of time that OMB has given to this to assure that would be the case.
Yes, if you want to just identify yourself for the record. And,
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm with the Department of Education. And I'd also like to talk about the department's support for this bill. We've been working with Senator Saltzman for many months, and every time that there has been a small concern raised or a large concern, we've worked through the problems, and we've come to a bill that we feel is it's a really good piece of legislation. We've got it's setting up a very transparent process for the different types of aid, and also is creating this charter schools facilities authority to work on the credit enhancement. So we are comfortable with this legislation. We think it's good policy, and we're supportive.
Thank you. And then Mr. Nathan, did you?
Good afternoon, Senator and members of the committee. My name is John Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself as an individual. I want to thank Senator Stumpf, Senator Saltzman, and other members of the Education Committee for their rigorous examination of three questions. I want to talk briefly with you about three questions and try to provide three answers as to why I think that this is good public policy. It's been my honor to work on this issue for more than a decade, and I think that just as the two national groups have recognized the charter public school law in Minnesota as the finest in terms of producing quality schools, which doesn't mean that we've solved all the problems, but two national groups have described the charter law in Minnesota as the nation's best in terms of producing strong schools and good oversight. I think this is another important step. We're currently working as a part of a project with the National Governors Association in six other states. And I can tell you that each of the six other states, governors have asked about this particular bill, and there's a considerable amount of interest in it. So I want to briefly describe three questions and three answers. First, is this a good bill for the taxpayers of the state? I'd say it is, because there's a basic principle in economics, which is that in the medium and long term, it is more efficient use of whether it's individual or public sector funds, to be purchasing rather than leasing. and this allows public funds to be used under careful, regulated circumstances to purchase buildings. So this allows the more efficient use of public dollars. I don't have to tell anyone around this table that regardless of your position on tax policy and other policy, there are plenty of demands on public funds, whether it's for the arts programs, whether it's for healthcare, whether it's for environment. There are plenty of demands on public funds. This allows public funds in this state to be spent more efficiently, and in the medium term, not just the long term, but in the medium term. Right now we have charter public schools that are receiving perhaps $250,000 a year in lease aid, and they're purchasing a building that is worth $1.2, $1.3 million. In fact, we've had testimony, Senator Stumpf and Senator Salzman had testimony on that precise point. So that in 4 or 5 years, a building is paid for. But under the current circumstance, the state owns nothing. It's still leasing the building. This allows public funds to purchase a building. So the first question to me is, the answer to the first question is yes, this is good public policy. It will allow us to save public funds. It will allow us to reduce the amount of money that the state is paying, because the state will be, the charter school will be able to purchase rather than lease buildings. So I think the answer to the first question is yes, this is good public policy. Second question is this good for public education, both district and charter public schools? As some of you know, our three children attended and graduated from the St. Paul Public Schools right where we're sitting. I've been married for more than 36 years to a public school teacher in this city. Our older daughter is a public school teacher in this city. We are deeply committed to public schools, not just theoretically, but very personally. I've also been a PTA president and on the state board of the PTA. I am deeply committed, as you are, to improving public education, whether it's in the district or charter sector. It seems to me that this is good for public education because, as Senator Salzman and others have noted, this brings together districts and charters. I'm delighted that, for example, the Minneapolis schools have decided to sell some of their vacant space to district public schools. That's a really good move. I know that the St. Paul schools is talking about further collaboration between the district and charters. This is all also happening in greater Minnesota. In Faribault, for example, the district is leasing space in a small town right outside Faribault to a charter public school. This is designed to bring together in greater collaboration district or charter and public and charter public schools. So I would say this is a step forward for public education, not just for charters. Finally, I think this is a good thing for the kids who attend charter public schools. Our research shows that the kids who attend charter public schools both in Minnesota and in the state represent a higher percentage of low-income kids, a higher percentage of students who don't speak English, a higher percentage of students of color. And yet, last year, the Minneapolis Star Tribune found that 6 of the 10 schools that were doing the best job of improving student achievement in schools serving high percentages of low-income kids were charter public schools, which doesn't mean to say that all the great schools in the state are charters. It does not mean to say that at all. There's some terrific district public schools. But we are finding that more than $120 million has come into this state from the U.S. Department of Education, which is, say, of course, our taxes, from foundations and other sources because Minnesota established the nation's first charter. So we have benefited materially and significantly in cash from the fact that we have established the charter law. This law allows more security for strong, and that's an important adjective, strong charter public schools. All charter public schools should not be given the privilege of public funds to purchase buildings. I want to say that again because it's an item of some controversy within the charter community. All charter public schools should not be given the privilege of using public funds to purchase buildings. This provides an incentive to move toward excellence. So the three questions I asked are, is this good for the state of Minnesota and its taxpayers? I believe the answer is yes. Is this good for public education? Again, I believe the answer is yes. Is this good for the youngsters who are attending charter public schools? Once again, I think the answer is yes. It's rare that they're going to be a win-win-win proposition, but I think with Senator Stumpf and Senator Salzman's good work, plus the other members of the task force that have been working with her, this is one of those rare win-win propositions. Finally, I think it's worth noting that under Senator Stumpf's leadership, this bill passed out of the committee unanimously. It was a bipartisan support. And that is unusual, and I think it reflects the fine work that Senator Salzman and Senator Stumpf did on this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nathan. Questions for Mr. Nathan? Senator Foley, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nathan, I appreciate your work in the education area and so on, but it's hard for me to believe that that I can take and send, as I have a niece attending a charter school, and And as I say before, that there was a student-teacher ratio of 28. And if I pull her out of there and put her in Minneapolis school where they live, we'll never get that kind of a shortfall. And so if you got more money to spend and to do, why isn't it?
I don't have more money.
Why isn't all of Minneapolis, for instance, have adequate teaching for their teachers?
I'm not sure that strikes you, but Mr. Nathan, do you?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm reluctant to comment on how the Minneapolis Public Schools operates because I'm not an expert on how Minneapolis Public Schools operate. One of the things that encourages me about this bill is it's providing greater collaboration. So, for example, at North High School in Minneapolis, the district has made an explicit decision to have both a district and a charter public school in the building. That makes more efficient use of that building, and I think that that's a net positive thing. That the district, both the school board and the teachers union, have agreed that they're going to pursue something that the legislature, in its wisdom, decided to do last year, which is to create site-governed schools. And the site-governed schools allow groups of parents and teachers to come forward in Minneapolis and other districts throughout the state to create new kinds of public schools based on research. Indeed, just this morning, I urged that the legislature consider taking a small amount of the startup funds from the charter area that the legislature provides and provide startup funds for site-governed schools. But I've already been asked by the teachers union in this city to meet with them, and there are some teachers in St. Paul Public Schools and teachers in Minneapolis Public Schools who see this as an opportunity to create new kinds of schools where they could lower the student-teacher ratio because they would be in charge of virtually all the money that comes into the district. And these would be district public schools spending money in somewhat different ways. So not just theoretically, sir, but very practically, there are public school teachers around the state who are now thinking about the site-governed school approach, who have developed ways that if the school boards approve them and the teachers unions approve them, because that's an important part, you have to have both district and union support for site-governed schools, that they could lower the student-teacher ratio. So I think that this is a possibility, and frankly, it's a tribute to the legislature, which said we're going to provide some new opportunities for school districts to create these kinds of programs.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Nellman can confirm this, but isn't it true, Mr. Nellman, that the students who attend the public charter schools in Minneapolis actually would be receiving less per pupil than those attending the district school because they don't have access to any of the referendum money? And I believe that because of the different compensatory issues that Minneapolis district schools probably get more than a charter school student in a Minneapolis charter school.
Mr. Chairman, no. Senator Roebling, as you sit on education finance, you're well-versed in this. As you know, the referendum piece, the aid does follow the student to the charter. The property tax levy in that circumstance that you painted does not. And compensatory revenue aid is calculated on a site-based level, so it's dependent upon the free and reduced count at an individual charter school compared to another charter school.
Okay. Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually was going to make the same point that the charter school students are not getting more aid than the public school students. And in some cases, as Mr. Nauman has described, they actually may be getting less.
Other questions for Mr. Nathan? Okay, well, thank you very much for being here. Sarah Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if Senator Salzman would like me to move that A-27 amendment. If so, I'd move the A-27 amendment.
Okay, that's been distributed. Senator Salzman, do you want to explain the amendment?
Yes. On that point, Mr. Chair, the A-27 amendment, there are some technical changes that I believe came from staff just regarding, you know, some language changes, but the two pieces that I do want to point out, beginning on line 1.16 and 1.28, I believe, these address issues regarding leases. that the organizations that a charter school may continue to lease from. And I think that, Mr. Nauman, I believe we've heard this bill so many times, I can't remember if we've told this committee yet or if it was last week, but the fact that many times landlords will set up LLCs or separate organizations, and we're trying to be very careful that we're closing the loophole on affiliated building corporations, but that we respect the fact that there are private landlords that set up what may look like an ABC but are not. And so, Mr. Nauman, would that be accurate in terms of the new language that we've worked out? This is something that we've been working on probably for about the last month, and we seem to feel pretty good about this language, so that it addresses conflict of interests between people who own buildings and people who are running charter schools. So those would be paragraph B and paragraph D. Mr. Nauman, is that correct?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, yes. The only thing I would add is that the bill, as the division report, does contain some language that attempts to address the issue in a similar way. We knew that we hadn't quite perfected it at that time. We did some additional work with the Department of Education and created some more generalized language that addressed the issue. But yes, that's exactly correct.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then these sections, the other pieces that are new in here reflect a request to deal with the fact that in coming before the charter school authority, that student achievement was something that we felt was important, that if we're going to be investing dollars in permanent facilities, that a school be showing academic success. And there was concern as to how we did that. And so you will see that on lines 2.19, it has to do with being able to show success in making medium and high growth. Although we heard from several schools that are serving students that may be very difficult to be able to document. And so we have added some new language that you will see on lines, starting on lines 3.5, that there is a waiver process, in essence, so that the commissioner can look at some other criteria before a school goes before the charter school for their endorsement. So this was to address, again, some concerns that were coming from the charter school advocates that wanted to make sure that we were realistic in what we were expecting schools to demonstrate, because a number of charter schools do really target these young people who are really struggling. So those were the two pieces that are changes here. There was one other small change on line 1.7 and 1.8. This has to do with single-purpose sponsor. In this bill, there are a couple policy issues related to conflict of interest, where charter school board members or else affiliated building company board members, in terms of contracts and receiving bonuses or receiving payment in regard to a bond on the bond sales. So we have cleaned that up as well in this bill.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saltzman, I'm looking at the paragraph B and D on the first page of the amendment, and I'm noticing that the space cannot be leased from board members or employees or people related to board members or employees. But what I don't see is any prohibition from people who are related to the students in the school. Would it be appropriate to be leasing space from the parent or the grandparent of the students that are going to these schools?
Yeah. And a question, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, that has not been brought up as a concern. I know that there could be the potential of parents coming together to invest in a school. I do know that there have been some cases where parents, and this is where these affiliated building companies have come together. We have not addressed that. It seemed to be that the people who are probably getting paid by a charter school, if they're staff, that there's this conflict of interest of, but I have not, we have not really addressed it. I do know there are some situations where parents have raised dollars or parents come together a lot of times to help form a charter school, that they are very much involved, although their children move on. That's one of the things I think that we want to make sure is that a school has stable leadership, so that it's not just a group of parents and their children graduate, but that's an interesting point. It had, we have not thought of that.
We've got the 827 amendment in front of us, as moved by Senator Stumpf. Is there further discussion on that amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And then there's probably another amendment, Senator Saltzman.
There. I believe, Mr. Chair, that there is another amendment that has to do with the bonding language from Mr. Watson.
Let's wait till it's distributed. This is the A28 amendment. Okay, Mr. Watson.
Thank you.
The bill is introduced, authorized charter school boards to sell bonds to construct facilities. But in the course of its passage through the Senate, the bill has changed so that instead of the issuing authority being a charter school board, it's this new charter school facilities authority, which is a state agency. The authority in the bill as it comes out of the division referred to that issuing authority having the powers of a municipality to issue bonds. Well, since it's now a state agency, what this amendment does is give to it the powers that a state agency like the Commissioner of Finance has to issue revenue bonds. And the particular boilerplate here is modeled on the boilerplate for the 911 revenue bonds in section 403.275.
Mr. Chairman, I'd
Senator Stumpf.
I would move the A28 amendment.
Okay, Senator Stumpf moves the A28 amendment. And Senator Saltzman,
yes, Mr. Chair, I'm fine with the A.
If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Are there further amendments on the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
I don't have an amendment, but I do just have a comment. And I, you know, I think it's admirable for us to try to encourage better outcomes. But I also think it's important for us to remember that for some kids, being in school through high school is a good outcome.
Any other comments, questions, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, if not, I'd be happy to move the bill and just want to comment that this has been an impressive presentation right down to color coordination.
They worked on that yesterday. Right. I know, Senator Saltzman, you've done, along with Senator Stumpf, a lot of work on this bill and in the division, as has been pointed out. So appreciate the time and presentation. Senator Olson moves that Senate file 2716 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Yeah.
Motion carries. All right. Thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate and your support.
And then, members, tomorrow we will meet at 8:30. And we have only nine bills tomorrow.